Despite marijuana's federal Schedule I status, academics continue to discover the truth, counter the propaganda, and unlock more benefits within humanity's most beneficial plant. Join us now as we speak with the pioneering researchers in cannabis in this edition of Sensimilla Science. Welcome back, everyone. 32 after the hour, and joining us via Skype, we've got Sam Mendez. He's a researcher at the University of Washington. Sam, welcome to the show. Sam, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, it's sort of in and out. I can just hear you now, so let's see if this connection works.
Okay, fantastic. Glad we've got you on the line. I was attracted to your work that came out is a couple of weeks ago now, where you were looking at the factors that involve a child's decision to eat or not eat something. Can you give us a little background on this research and what prompted you to undertake it?
Sure. Yeah. Well, the Cannabis Law and Policy Project here at the University of Washington School of Law, we're essentially a nascent think tank that's dedicated to researching policy and legal and other issues relating to cannabis. So the Liquor and Cannabis Board here in Washington State, the WSLCB, had contracted with us to produce two reports for them. This is the second of those two. And we were tasked with sort of advising their policies on edibles with respect to concern of keeping them away from children. So tackling the question of what exactly about food itself and the branding and packaging around the food could make it attractive to children.
So this just wasn't about cannabis edibles specifically, but just in general, what attracts kids to food?
Yeah, exactly. And that was actually for a very practical and ethical issue that I don't know of any research out there in which cannabis-infused edibles are tested on children.
Yeah.
And there's ethical issues with that of having children try it. So
I can imagine it'd be tough to have the cannabis gummy group versus the placebo gummy group. Exactly.
Right. Exactly. I don't know if there would you'd get funding anywhere for that. But we figured, the same principles would apply for cannabis-infused food or regular food about what a child would be attracted to.
All right. So what were some of the conclusions that you found? What made food attractive to kids?
Right. Yeah. So our conclusions were nothing groundbreaking, but it did provide, a solid research foundation that the LCB can rely upon both for the present and in the future if they should revise their policies. So we essentially had two large categories. One was the food itself, and then the other was the branding and packaging of the food. So around the food itself, we looked at four subcategories, and that was it was the color, the shape of the food, as well as the smell and the taste of the food. Now, our conclusions were, surprise, surprise, that children are attracted to bright colors, particularly red and yellow. Particularly young children are attracted to interesting shaped foods, such as bears or stars, as opposed to just regular stick or not uninteresting shapes. And then with taste and smell, on par, we found research that showed that children are attracted to sweet tasting and smelling foods, as opposed to sour or bitter. Or other flavors that might be more attractive to adults. So again, no real surprise there, but it does provide some research basis to things that we already find intuitive.
In Colorado, they had already adjusted their edible manufacturing rules to forbid the manufacture of anything shaped like an animal or a shape or a human. What other recommendations would you make as far as crafting Washington's laws? What recommendations did you make for these edible products?
Right. So the second category, we also found that branding and packaging had a very strong impact on a child's choice of food. So a classic example would be children's cereal, where you have very bright colors with mascots or other characters that are represented by them. And then something like Lucky Charms also have interesting shapes in there as well. So I think one thing that was sort of intriguing was that none of these factors was clearly indicative of child automatically being attracted. So no one factor we concluded was an entirely essential portion. But we did find that on a broad level, looking at all of these categories together would be a better approach. So sort of having a certain number factor test in approaching, from a regulatory standpoint in approaching a product. Now, the LCB already has, like Colorado, they already have policies around around edibles, and it's pretty general in nature. It's basically foods or products will not be allowed to be sold that are likely to be attractive to children, and they do have in parentheses such as gummy bears and lollipops. So they already didn't allow, for example, infused gummy bears. And this provides the research support for that. As whether the LCB will revise their policies in the future, I'm not really sure. But in sum, essentially, sell products that are not likely to be attractive to children, and based on these factors, dark or non-bright colors, such as brown or black, both with the packaging and the food. Not interesting shapes, so no bears or animal crackers or things like that. Now, taste and smell is actually a little bit more difficult. And, I have had people suggest to me, well, what if we make brownies taste a little bit more bitter or add something to that? But the industry would be up in arms over that. I mean, they are still, after all, selling sweet foods. So that could be harder to regulate. I'm not making any value judgment on what the LCB should do, but you can see why that would be more difficult to regulate.
Yeah, it's something that comes up for those of us adults on the cannabis consumption side is that we like candy too. and
right.
It's, I actually looked up the figures from the American Confectioners Association, and they tell me that 2 out of 3 gummy bears manufactured are eaten by adults. So is it just going to be a situation where we're likely, if we want to have gummy bears or gummy products, we're just going to have to make the compromise of them being brown and shapeless? Is that it?
Yeah. I mean, I haven't heard of any banning or disallowing of, shapeless brown gelatinous candy.
There we go.
I think that would pass the test. But I do think for now consumers and the industry will probably have to resolve themselves to not buying infused bear shaped foods. We did also acknowledge in the paper that an important factor here is also parental responsibility. Just about everybody agrees that we should keep this product away from children, although this is not a product that does, very easily kill a child. There's no lethal dose of cannabis. But this was also not the first dangerous product that is found in a household. I mean, alcohol is already in many people's households. But, of course, cleaning agents and pharmaceutical drugs are very common, and their parents have a responsibility to keep those out of reach and away from children as well. So that we just had that sort of as a disclaimer early on in the report that we are here to advise the LCB on this research and providing these factors and findings. But at the same time, from a regulatory standpoint, the government can only do so much. And in order to keep children safe, of course, parents are the first responders there.
I'm glad you bring up that disclaimer, because as we look at the poison control statistics in America, the fastest growing category of these accidental ingestions isn't cannabis. It's those laundry pods, like those Tide jelly looking laundry pods that kids are getting into. Nobody's calling on them to manufacture them in shapeless brown packages. But thank you for bringing that up. Sam, before we close things up here, I want to make sure that if you've got any contact information, websites, or helpful resources for our listeners out there, that you get a chance to promote those for us. Could you?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. I'll also just put in a plug that the Cannabis Law and Policy Project is currently actively in our fundraising campaign. So we're seeking to raise $250,000 by the end of October. So if any of your listeners are interested in contributing, please feel free to reach out to me. You can email me directly at smendez@uw.edu. That's SMENDEZ at uw.edu. We also have a webpage that links to our the times we're quoted in the media, as well as our reports and our blog as well that we regularly update. The URL is a little bit long, but it's law.washington.edu/programs/cannabis.
Fantastic.
You can also just Google us and you'll find us as well.
Fantastic. And just pause and rewind if you need to get that address again. I know it was a long one. Now, Sam, before I let you go, you mentioned this was the second report your group has put out for WSLCB. Mm-hmm. Can you give us a brief understanding of what your first report was?
Sure. Yeah. The first report had to do with estimating canopy space for the medical marijuana market. So this was all within the frame of in Washington State merging their medical unregulated system with cannabis and the far heavily regulated and taxed recreational marijuana system. We, for a few years, had been existing within these two spaces, and it was problematic for the LCB to have this because it, you know, the unregulated market was sort of undermining the regulated recreational market. So they sought to merge that. It was very controversial. You know, there was, you know, people on both sides arguing about how to do it right. But all that, be that as it may, they tasked us with estimating as these two markets merge, and the end date for that would be July 1st, 2016, would there be enough cannabis sold in stores to satisfy patients? And we concluded that between 1.7 to 2 million square feet of canopy space would satisfy that market. It was intended to be sort of a broad snapshot of estimating just by raw weight how much cannabis would be used by patients across the state. There were other questions out there that was just beyond the scope of the report, such as patient access to these stores and or are they getting their specific strain or product or potency that they're used to? And we just didn't address those as we, you know, we had a specific task that we had to complete.
As someone who is a regular researcher on various topics, is there anything about researching cannabis that is odd or different than other topics?
Sure. Well, the two things that come to mind is the federal illegality and that we are very much in a brave new world here. You know, I mean, I couldn't imagine anybody would have predicted this 20 years ago. And even 10 years ago was, you know, you've seen an incredibly fast shift here across the country. There's still, it's still very much developing, but you can expect this brave new world to be happening for many years to come. You know, there's a good chance that California could legalize this year by their ballot, and that would just be a huge sea change. You know, it'd be a very large domino to fall. They're the seventh largest economy in the world, easily larger than all the four currently legal states combined. So I think it's a fascinating area to study, and I love my job. So I love that it's very quickly developing. And then, of course, this is still so cutting edge that it's still illegal at the federal level. So there's a lot of stigma around it, both in society at large, but also within the legal community in particular. So it's very interesting and very exciting for a number of reasons.
Sam Mendez from the University of Washington, I want to thank you for joining us here in our Sensimilla Science segment, and good luck with your future research.
Not a problem. Thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it, Russ.
All right, folks, stay tuned. When we come back, we've got another great interview guest coming up, Ryan Denham from Arkansas Compassion, discussing the two competing medical marijuana amendments.
This is the Russ Belville Show on CannabisRadio.com.